Is this ready?
Hello.
Yes.
We're pleased to welcome you to a forum in the series we've been having on arms control and foreign policy, with particular reference to the presidency. One person who has been as continuously active in this field as anyone I know is Professor Franklin Long of Cornell University. He was, for a time, chairman of the chemistry department. He came to that in an interesting way. He got his bachelor's degree and master's degree from the University of Montana. He had been born in Great Falls, Montana. He received his PhD degree from the University of California and taught there for a time, and then the University of Chicago, and then returned to, and then came to Cornell. He was an instructor 1 year, and the next year he was a full professor. And that ought to have signaled something to the people who observed him in his work at that time. The breadth of his interest, though, was evident when he was named to the Henry Luce Professorship of Science and Society, and simultaneously was director of the program on science, technology, and society at Cornell University. He was also thereafter director of a peace studies program. He was a member of the President's Science Advisory Committee from 1961 to 1966, and this afternoon some of you will be talking with him about science advising. He was an assistant director of the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and director of the Arms Control Association of the United States from 1971 to 1976. He was co-chairman of the American Pugwash Steering Committee from 1974 to 1979. He's been a trustee of the Alfred Sloan Foundation in New York, a trustee of Cornell University, fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the AAAS, a member of the American Chemical Society. A recent book, which was published first in Daedalus magazine and then in a single volume work published by Norton Publishers, entitled Weapons and Space, looks at the whole issue of weapons in space in terms of pro and con issues, in terms of Soviet-American relations, in terms of all the other issues which enter into play. So do a vast number of articles he's written with titles that suggest the focus of his interest. Do peaceful nuclear explosions have a future? A step toward nuclear sanity, a rapidly negotiable first stage nuclear freeze, advancing military technology, recipe for an arms race, the decision-making role of Congress, the decision process for U.S. military R&D, unilateral initiatives in arms control. All of these interests suggest a broad and ongoing interest in the arms control field and a major contribution. We're delighted to have him with us today, and we look forward to his presentation and his discussion with you.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here. I've long admired both the program here and Kenneth Thompson, so that be able to visit both is very attractive. I do come with considerable apprehension as I I casually accepted this topic, and then I found that my knowledge was a little scanty, particularly on what I'd call the diplomacy side, so that I felt that I was coming into a group of people who probably knew more and more in detail about some of the diplomatic and foreign relations aspects in which arms control involved than I do. And so I take that chance. I'll present it, and people who want to correct me, I'll listen to with great interest. In thinking about the topic, which is arms control and the presidency, you immediately begin to ask yourself how big a fraction of a president's concern in diplomatic foreign affairs things is arms control or arms control and disarmament. And you, in the end, you have to conclude that it's not, in terms of time and consideration, it's not a really major topic. If you ask what are the major topics, I'm not even sure I know. Their boundaries, their alliances, their trade, their treaties, their third world problems, their peaceful settlements of disputes, a whole set of things that you think of as the State Department as being the center of action. And then another set you think of the Department of Defense being the center of action. And arms control, which is in between those two perhaps, really doesn't rate all that much. And I found an interesting confirmation, a very nice book that I've read and liked. It's now 10 years old. It was one by George Ball, which is labeled Diplomacy in a Crowded World. And it is a nice book. He's a man of positive opinions and interesting ones. And so I thought, well, I'll go through that book, which ends in 76, but covers about another 8 years or 10 years before that, and see how much about arms control and disarmament is in it. The answer is not very much. And to give you concrete evidence, in the index of the book, on arms control, no references. On disarmament, no references. There is one heading called Arms Race, comma, Efforts to Control. That gets 3 references. On the other hand, arms sales gets 14 references, trade gets 11 references, and so on. So George managed to write a very interesting and significant book without having very much to say about this particular topic. Let me, before I go on, define arms control so that it's clear we know what we're talking about. The standard definition that sort of tends to be published these days is that arms control is defined as measures to, 1, reduce the likelihood of war, 2, reduce the cost of war, 3, reduce the death and destruction if war does come. The other half of the arms control disarmament, of course, means what it says, namely disarmament. Now, I will use the topic as sort of arms control plus some disarmament, as my arms control will be a shorthand for that. Now, what has happened clearly is that in the last 40 years, that arms control and disarmament have become a significantly more important topic, that the attention of presidents has, even though still perhaps not major by any manner of means, has nevertheless increased a lot. The awareness of the public on potential role of arms control disarmament has equally clearly increased in the years. And I think the answer is a very simple one, namely that roughly 40 years ago we moved into the nuclear weapons age when one had to think in terms of a war in which these really devastating weapons might be used. And if you want an illustration of the way that topic is becoming increasingly of concern, think of the Reykjavik summit of the other day, when in people talking initially, why it was understood that there would be some talk about trade, some talk about grain sales, some talk about human rights, but in the end it was almost all about arms control and disarmament. That I think is an illustration of the significance it's now playing. There is no question that the nuclear weapons have changed the world. They've just modified how you think about war, how you think about relations with nuclear armed countries. And fundamentally, that's because, one, the nuclear weapons themselves are simply incredibly efficient, incredibly cheap, incredibly destructive. People frequently define order of magnitude as a factor of 10. If something jumps by a factor of 10, you say that's a breakthrough, that's an order of magnitude change. Well, for nuclear weapons, their explosiveness per unit weight has gone up over previous explosives is like a factor of a million. So that it's just a tremendously different thing. And when you add to that the development of intercontinental rockets and a few other new and interesting weapons, you get a further sense of the change, because there's now another order of magnitude in speed of delivery. A current ICBM will deliver a nuclear weapon from one continent to another, here to the Soviet Union or the inverse, in a half an hour. It will carry 3, 6, 8, 10 nuclear warheads independently targeted. And if you think of a typical one, it might weigh a couple hundred pounds. It might have a destructiveness of 100,000 tons of TNT equivalent. So that gives you some idea of the destruction that is involved in one ICBM. So that's the world we now live in. And it's a world, of course, in which the combination of the two things, these intercontinental weapons and the nuclear weapons, means that national security has decreased enormously for this country, notably, but it's also decreased enormously, and for the same reason, for the Soviet Union, and indeed for a lot of other countries, all because of this combination of destructiveness and speed and accuracy that we now face. It's meant that one looks on war in a somewhat different way. It used to be that you had weapons which were sometimes labeled defensive weapons, sometimes labeled offensive weapons. It often turned out they were the same weapon. Nuclear weapons, it's a little clearer. I mean, it's very hard to think of a nuclear weapon. Well, it's hard to think of it as seriously as either. I mean, it simply is too destructive. The thought of saying, well, we're going to start an offensive nuclear war against the Soviet Union, the amount of destruction involved is so catastrophic that it's hard even to contemplate. I should stop that. And what it really meant is that we've really changed what we rely on to prevent war. We've moved from thinking about defense to thinking about deterrence. And second strike retaliatory deterrence has been our stance of how to avoid nuclear war for now 30 years at least. It also means that you get very much more concerned about accidental war, because it really sort of, in the end, doesn't matter too much what starts a nuclear war. If it's accidental, if it's a terrorist, the terrible danger is that it will escalate into the potential that 500 or 1,000 of these destructive weapons will give for almost changing the face of the world. Well, it's in this context, then, that one is thinking about arms control. It's in this context that one can say, what has made it possible for the United States and the Soviet Union to make really quite significant progress on arms control over the last 25 years, roughly? It is because of this mutual position they're in of potential destruction from either side, and a mutual interest in trying to reduce the risk of war, reduce the casualties from war, so that something that normally you would have thought would be pretty unlikely, namely that two countries with different governmental systems, different governmental philosophies, could in fact continue to work as they have on arms control. The situation in the U.S., the public is now into arms control and disarmament. It is both becoming supportive, it's also notably volatile. Sometimes it will be in support, sometimes again. I remember a three-year period when the public feeling in this country about banning nuclear weapons tests changed from 70% in favor of a ban to 60% against a ban in a three-year period. Now, that was in the early days, but that kind of volatility has been with this. It, by the way, is shared by Congress also, because Congress, too, will sometimes be substantially strongly in favor of arms control, sometimes will begin to phase off. For a variety of reasons, we've ended up putting the major activity, the major thrust, in the hands of the executive branch, and specifically in the hands of the president. Our situation, as you all know, is sort of unique in the focus of the government on the president, in the powers of the executive branch. I'm sure that's been discussed many times in this room, and because of that, why the president appears both as an initiator of programs, as the communication link from a lot of elements of the government to the American people through television and other things, and as a person that personally almost inescapably ends up getting involved in discussions with other nations in the way that he was at Reykjavik, President Reagan was. In thinking of the role of the executive branch and of the president in particular, I remembered something that was put in a book by an OECD book examining U.S. science policy. It had a graph of the president of the United States to explain this, I suppose, principally to Europeans. And it was so interesting that I brought a couple copies of it and I'll sort of pass it around. It's just, it gives you some feeling as to the role of that particular job. Well, I should go beyond that and get down to cases. I think it one must recognize that the president is of such significant importance to most decisions, and certainly uniquely almost to arms control in this country. The three propositions that I'd like to advance and then talk about presidents in terms of, I should read to you. And proposition one is, you can decide whether there's a case for these propositions later. Proposition one is that without active support from the president and active participation by him, there is little chance for significant arms control agreements. It really takes the president and active involvement really to get anywhere. That's, I think, been demonstrated over and over again. And secondly, is that even the active presidents have, in my personal judgment, been unduly timid about arms control, have failed adequately to educate the U.S. public about alternatives and directions in which arms control enters. And I think, in turn, when public support has been very strong, have tended not to use it very much. So that I think that the president hasn't sort of incorporated, on the average, have not incorporated the citizen view about arms control disarmament adequately. And the third proposition is that many presidents have been called and a few have chosen to respond. That's not a serious proposition, but it is a fact that by no means every president that one might have thought would has in fact responded with much vigor. The presidents I'll talk about then, and I'd like to shift over and say what did they do and what didn't they do. Are the ones, it's really the post-war group, and I excluded Truman simply because that was a period in which things were settling down after the war. It was a volatile period in which the Korean War came along and was distracting, and one was in effect putting together positions. Arms control and disarmament played a pretty small role in that particular era, so it seemed to me more sensible to start with Eisenhower. President for 8 years, ending in 1960. Kennedy, 2 2/3 years, ending in 63. Johnson, 5+ years, ending in 68. Nixon, 5+, ending in 74. Ford, 2 or 3, ending in 76. Carter with 4 years up to 1980, and finally President Reagan with 6 years so far and two coming. And what I thought I would do would be just to go through what seemed to me to be the way these presidents involve themselves in arms control and disarmament, and a little bit then as to how effective they were. In Eisenhower's case, I think it's impressive how significantly he did involve himself in arms control. He did very early in his administration appoint an assistant, a special assistant for arms control and disarmament, Harold Stassen. And looking back, one can wonder whether that was the ideal choice, but nevertheless, he did have such a person who was worrying about it. He himself made a rather dramatic proposal. It wasn't quite arms control, but very closely to it, the so-called Open Skies proposal back in 55. When he began to get actively involved in it, really was about 57. And the reason was nuclear fallout. By then, the hydrogen bomb had been developed. The United States had set off a really big hydrogen bomb, 15 megatons or so, of TNT equivalent, on a little atoll on the South Pacific. It generated a great deal of fallout, far more than had been predicted. The winds didn't behave as they were supposed to, and a great deal of fallout fell on a Japanese fishing boat, and one man died, and another 8 or 10 were seriously afflicted by fallout, and a great many native in the region of this atoll were also seriously covered, and at that time both the United States and the Soviet Union were testing quite a bit. They were all testing to a first approximation was in the atmosphere, so that if there was a test, well, you could be sure that there was once again a little addition of radioactivity to the atmosphere. And this became a worldwide problem. There was a period when there was a rumor in among distant native tribes in Africa that fallout caused a loss of male virility, and so that there were protests about it from people who barely understood what the term meant, as well as anything else. It was a widely troublesome thing to publics all around, and the pressure, therefore, for a nuclear test ban was pretty substantial. Those are the days you could get a 70% vote in the United States, even then requesting or urging a test ban. I think it's fair to say that President Eisenhower was hesitant, but in the end he did act. What's one of the explanations for his hesitancy? I personally think a very important one is that he had a set of pretty conservative advisors, including a good many that had a sort of professional interest in continuing nuclear tests. And I think in particular of the people in the Atomic Energy Commission. Dulles was, I think, a moderately conservative person, but I think particularly Strauss, who was the chairman of the Atomic Energy during that period, Edward Teller, who was the father of the hydrogen bomb and already recognized as so, and people like Ernest Lawrence from California, for whom the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory is named. And it was these people that were the normal people for Eisenhower to turn to. They were the professionals in the field, but they also were people who had, therefore, a professional interest. It would make a great deal of difference after a few years when he got a full-time presidential advisor, not so coupled in James Killian. And there's no question that the combination of Killian as a presidential advisor and later to Eisenhower, George Kistikowski, and the existence of a new entity called the President's Science Advisory Committee greatly broadened the people he could turn to for advice and did turn to. But in the early years, he was really pretty hesitant. In 57, the Soviet Union proposed two moratoria on nuclear weapons tests. Said, let's stop testing for a while and think how to ban them. In both cases, Eisenhower, with considerable hesitancy, rejected them. And that in spite of the fact that the U.S. was in fact in favor of a comprehensive test ban during that period. Khrushchev came in place, again came back to proposing a moratorium on tests, and this time the U.S. responded in an interesting way. They responded not by setting up a moratorium, but by suggesting a three-nation committee of experts to see if you could verify when these tests occurred. And UK, US, USSR experts met in Geneva in the summer of 1958, spent just 6 weeks or so together, came up with a conclusion that yes, to a considerable degree, and for a variety of nuclear weapons tests, you could verify. They came up with a monstrously expensive international Geneva verification system, which would have cost $1 billion or $2 to install and $500 million a year to run, but nevertheless it was a proof that that you could verify. And that led Eisenhower to propose that the three nations get together and see if they could arrange a ban on nuclear testing. And Eisenhower offered a test moratorium for as long as those negotiations were underway. The Soviet accepted, and negotiations started, and for 3 years there was a complete moratorium on nuclear weapons tests by the United States, the Soviet Union, and the United Kingdom. And when the negotiations ultimately failed, testing was resumed. At first it looked very promising, these negotiations. It looked like a lot of progress was being made. Pessimism began to come in, and I have to confess that some of it was flatly the United States' fault. The United States threw a real monkey wrench into the discussions by bringing in some, quote, new data, unquote. There were a set of data which I think were brought in honestly. I don't, this is not, there were no invention, but it brought in a set of data which said that there were a good many more earthquakes in the world, and notably in the Soviet Union, than had been predicted before that would have to, in the end, be identified as explosives so that they didn't fall into the category of tests. So it meant that the verification would be harder by a factor of four because of these new data. And the Russians were furious because they thought they knew how many earthquakes they had, and this seemed to be saying they had more of a given size than they thought they had. And it really was a very serious thing, and it turns out that about 4 years later, during the days I was involved in Washington, the United States came back to the table and said those data were false. I mean, it had been innocently false, but anyway, false. But it was a loss of opportunity, and no agreement was made during the Eisenhower period. Now, if you ask why, I think you do have to say that Eisenhower wanted a test ban. He wrote in his memoirs that one of the saddest facts in retrospect that was his failure to negotiate a nuclear test ban. On the other hand, I think sort of reading the record, you can't help but feel that some pressure from Eisenhower on the U.S. delegation to push these agreements to get something done would have made an enormous difference. And he really was very hands off. So that, and in a certain sense, setting up that committee of experts had in it elements of a cop out. You didn't really need these people to get together for 3 months to say yes, you can. It was pretty evident that the capabilities were pretty good, and that could have been done as part of a negotiation. Anyway, it represents, I think, the case of a president who really was interested in arms control, and there's no doubt that, and really skeptical of war, very worried about nuclear weapons, and yet at the same time, in the end, he didn't really push the people and say, you know, let's. Prove it to me that we're in trouble. Anyway, it was a loss, and we ended the Eisenhower period with no test ban and, in fact, no arms control agreements of any sort. Comes Kennedy. Kennedy comes in, it's worth remembering, essentially as a hawk, a mild hawk, but nevertheless. His part of his campaign was a missile gap, that the Russians were way ahead of us in nuclear missiles, which turned out to be quite false in the end. But it was part of the campaign. It was a president that did give his assent to the Bay of Pigs. It was a president that brought as a new element into the government a lot of activity on civil defense, and there were serious skeptics about whether civil defense was a priority item and the most important thing we could do about the nuclear problem of nuclear war. And in any case, it was interesting that it was Congress that stopped civil defense. They stopped it by turning off the purse strings, and they're closing up the purse strings, and the program sort of faded out. But the interesting point was that as he was in the government, he began to get more and more persuaded that arms control was needed, and began to be more and more active in it. And I would like to believe that if he'd had another 6 or 7 years in the presidency, a great deal would have happened. He did urge continuing of negotiations for the test ban, even after the moratorium had stopped, even after the Soviet Union had initiated retesting, and the United States followed and also tested. In spite of that, the president urged that the negotiations go ahead. They did resume. It was then, and formally in the presence of the new negotiations in 1962, that the U.S. withdrew the so-called new data, which had been introduced a few years before, and there was really a lot of progress. The lack of agreement between the two negotiating groups turned out to hinge on something that, in retrospect, looks remarkably small. It was on the number of quote, on-site inspections, with the U.S. saying 3 but no more. I'm sorry, the Soviet Union ultimately saying 3 but no more, and we very ultimately saying no less than 7, so that it was between 7 and 3 that things ultimately floundered. Some cynic afterwards said they seemed to have forgotten the number 5. but it was as close as that for a treaty. I won't bother you with the ins and outs. We can talk about that later if you want. I think in the end, the end came at a curious time. The Cuban Missile Crisis had occurred, and relations were strained with the Soviet Union. After that, Khrushchev wrote a confidential letter to the president saying, I hear from some of your people that you might be willing to accept 3 on-site inspections, and I'm willing, in the interest of getting a treaty, also to accept 3. And can't we get together, and our negotiators get together and negotiate a treaty on 3 on-site inspections? Well, we went into the, and I was in the Arms Control Agency at that time. There was certainly nobody formal who had ever gone below the official 7. And the negotiation started in this country, just between one Soviet negotiator and the head of our arms control agency, Bill Foster. And we went in with 7 and stayed there, and the Soviet Union came in with 3 as their number and stayed there. And after 6 weeks or 2 months, well, negotiations broke off in failure. And I personally think that again, it was really lack of the final initiative from President Kennedy. I called one of his special assistants during that period while I was thinking about these things, and said, wasn't the president becoming frightened about the Congress and the response of Congress? And he said, well, not explicitly, but he was worried about what the Council of the Committee on Foreign Relations of the U.S. Senate would do. And I think he would have negotiated, but as far as I know, the number 3 stayed on the table. Anyway, it without knowing the details, it certainly does look as though worries about the ratification of the treaty and so on could have entered. Well, the interesting point was Kennedy came back to the problem. and gave his famous 1983 American University speech, in which he said, we can't leave it this way. We ought to make one more effort to try to get agreement on this thing. And we, the United States, will offer a moratorium on atmospheric testing, which is the one that causes fallout, and will agree not to test unless some other nation vigorously tests in the atmosphere. And can't we, said he publicly, get back and negotiate? And then it was arranged very quickly that the Russians agreed to, Khrushchev agreed to agree. What happened in the end was that there was a rapid negotiation under Averell Harriman in July of 83, and in 2 weeks the two nations had agreed to a limited test ban treaty covering all atmospheres and places except underground. And the limited test ban treaty came in, was signed, was accepted by 100 other nations, is still in force. But the brass ring, the comprehensive test ban treaty, was not negotiated. And we've been trying to get rid of that one area, underground testing, off and on ever since. Well, all this happened very quickly. The treaty was signed in July. It was forwarded to the U.S. Senate for ratification very soon. That was done in 24 September by a vote of 80-19 in the Senate. It went into force on 10th of October. A real, you know, that for diplomatic negotiations is very rapid indeed. So that it was all over then. It was about a month later, I guess, roughly, that Kennedy was assassinated. And everybody will speculate what might have happened had he, having got this significant success, gone on to. One turns then to Lyndon Johnson. Now, there are a lot of reasons why Johnson might have be expected not to pay very much attention to arms control. He was the great society man. He took as his prime area to improve social justice and minimize the number of poor, and a great set of society welfare state kinds of things were very much on Johnson's mind. And if that was a period of great passing of important measures in this country. And one also knows that toward the end of his term, he got deeply distracted by the Vietnam War, and one might have asked, well, between those two major concerns, why, where's arms control? Well, the interesting thing is that he was quite effective in generating and supporting arms control. He did take some significant initiatives. We passed an outer space treaty, which banned orbiting nuclear weapons in space, and placing them on the moon, and a few other sillinesses. But it was a good treaty, and it's been a useful treaty, and it's still in force. He helped with the Latin American Nuclear Free Zone Treaty. The Latin Americans really did it. It was really their initiative, and they took the pressure. But it was important that the major powers be supportive, and the United States was formally so, and I think very usefully so. And we were involved in the sense that we had territories like Puerto Rico that were within the zone that the Latin Americans tended to say was the nuclear-free zone they wanted. And they wanted to be sure that we didn't expand or use this area. Anyway, it was a place where the U.S. was very helpful. The most important treaty in the Johnson period was the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which started with what had been on the... A lot of these treaties are in the wind for years before they finally get negotiated. And I think that was true for nuclear non-proliferation. The case here, what one was after, was very clear. It was clear that everybody, certainly the superpowers, would be worse off the more nations had nuclear weapons. That is, the proliferation of nuclear weapons to a lot of countries around the world was bound to be concerning for use in war, for possible escalation from use in war, for accidental launch. There were all sorts of reasons why both nations had a real interest in trying to minimize the spread of nuclear weapons. And the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was signed, mostly negotiated in the Johnson period and signed in the period, was a treaty designed to persuade as many non-nuclear nations as possible to sign on and say, we will never go nuclear. And the treaty is still in force. How much it has had to do with the slowdown in the spread of nuclear weapons to other countries, it's hard to say. I think it probably quite a bit. But I think partly it was that lots of nations really didn't want to go nuclear, and to be able to sign with other nations and say we forswear these weapons was something that many of them might have wanted. Anyway, for a person who was terribly distracted in other directions, it seems to me Johnson's accomplishments were pretty good. Now I come to the star of those presidents, and that was Richard Nixon. He is the president under whom far more agreements, treaties were negotiated, and significant ones than any other. Exactly how important was his asset, clearly crucial, how much was due to the industry and effectiveness of Henry Kissinger, you know, it's introspective, but never mind. It was an administration in which an awful lot got accomplished. There was a very off the bat, however, there was a major failure, and it does illustrate the kind of difficulties that you can get into. The failure was that we did not even attempt to negotiate a treaty that would have banned something called multiple independently targeted reentry vehicles, MIRVs. This is the idea of putting anything from 3 to 15 separate nuclear warheads and separately targeted ones on a single launch unit, a single ICBM or a single ballistic missile on a submarine. It was the kind of way to rapidly to expand your force by replacing one warhead, one big one, by 10 small ones, and targeting in different ways. Very efficient. United States had a very strong lead in that area, technically. It had started as a possible response to Soviet arms control, ballistic missile, anti-ballistic missile system. But it then got taken up in its own right. It was perfectly clear to everyone that if we had MIRVs and if the Soviets had MIRVs, the world would be less stable, because there's a clear incentive for a first strike. You could say, if I shoot my rocket, I will be shooting out 10 warheads at the opponent. If I leave it in the ground and one warhead of his hits it, well, I've lost those 10. So that the incentive to be first was clearly greater in a system in which both parties had them. And the worry was that the Russians would in fact do it. They did in fact do it. We have a MIRV world. There was a lot of pressure from people who recognized this with the new administration to say, move quickly and stop this. And I personally remember spending a day with four or five other people who felt similarly of the danger with Henry Kissinger. Henry was newly in the position of being chairman of the National Security Council for the president. And so we tried to say, you know, who's an old friend to all of us? We said, here's your chance. You can really get something done quickly, but if you don't do it quickly, it won't happen. And Kissinger's argument with us was that he just couldn't do it. He didn't blink about it. He was candid. He said he just was unwilling to take it, that his position was a weak one, people didn't know where he was coming out, and that he didn't believe that he dared take as his first significant move an arms control move. Many years later, he admitted that it was one of the serious mistakes of his life that he hadn't. But it was a failure. So the Nixon period started off as a failure, and then really began to move into high gear. To give you a summary of how much the Nixon administration did in roughly 5 years, they had three agreements which were less serious than treaties. They had a convention on banning biological weapons, which was started by Nixon announcing unilaterally that the United States A, would never use them. B, was going to destroy its stockpiles of biological weapons. And C, was going to dismantle any factories that we had for them. So that very bold move ended up rather rapidly in an agreement, an international agreement, banning biological weapons. Five treaties, no less, including some quite important ones, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the SALT I bilateral agreement, which was not a treaty, but nevertheless was a very important move, a threshold nuclear test ban was agreed to during and signed during Nixon's period. Other things in the same area, of course, everybody knows he restored U.S.-Chinese relations, and fundamentally started the SALT II negotiations. So that it was an optimistic period. The famous 1972 meeting when he went to the Soviet Union and signed the SALT I interim agreement and the ABM treaty, and then a number of working relations with the Soviet Union. Exchange of scientists and other educators and so on. It was a very, it was this the period of detente, one will remember. And it did sour sooner or later. I'll say very little bit about Gerald Ford. Little happened in his sort of roughly 3 years. It's not surprising. It had been this big accomplishment. He was new, inexperienced. They did complete another limited test ban treaty for peaceful uses, was not important. The only significant thing, really, was that he signed, along with Brezhnev at Vladivostok, a plan for SALT II treaty, which really was the breakthrough, and said that now all we have to do is dot the I's and cross the T's and we'll have a treaty. It took, incidentally, 5 years to do that. It was 5 years from that, 1974, Gerald Ford, Brezhnev signing of the basic components of a SALT II treaty until the treaty itself was signed, which says something about the problems of arms control. The tragic person in that set of presidents probably is Jimmy Carter. He came in as a dedicated man of peace. That was he ran strongly on his desire for peace. He clearly wanted to negotiate arms control, and in the end, ended up with a few modest accomplishments, not trivial either, but missed some of the really important ones. I won't say much. I asked someone politically why they thought, and one comment was that the most important thing that he did, and the thing that took a great deal of effort and cost him a lot of brownie points with a lot of senators and congressmen, was to negotiate the treaty with Panama. And that maybe was the major sort of negotiating, diplomatic accomplishment of his period. It started off in a curiously unhappy way with responding to his commitment. He went very quickly after he came in power in March of 1977 with his Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, to the Soviet Union and came to discuss the possibility of substantially strengthening the components of the SALT II treaty, which was sort of 90% negotiated at about that point. And the Russians were incensed. They felt that someone was throwing a, you know, for reasons that they couldn't understand, the United States was going back on a serious negotiation which was almost completed. And anyway, they rejected it pretty flatly. And so that it ended up going back to finishing the SALT II treaty, but it certainly slowed it down by something like a year. SALT II treaty was negotiated finally. Was a major accomplishment, was signed in 1979, was sent to the Senate. even though it was getting increasingly clear that this was after Afghanistan, or at least as Afghanistan came along, that the likelihood of getting ratification from the Senate was very small, and finally the President withdrew it, President Carter withdrew it, so that it was a signed treaty but not ratified, and stays that way, of course, to this day. President Carter had reopened negotiations on a comprehensive test ban treaty, and they had gone along very well, and were, in the words of the U.S. negotiator, head negotiator, 95% to 98% completed, and apparently Carter held back completing it on the basis that he wanted his priority to be on SALT II, and that was a more important treaty, and that. And so in the end, it turned out that the negotiation was not finished. The comprehensive test ban never came up for consideration. SALT II signed, but withdrawn. So when you put it all together, you could say, here's a man who came in with a real commitment to try to negotiate, and in fact did very much less than Nixon had done, and on the whole, not very much. I think I'll not spend much time with the last president, Ronald Reagan, except to note that it's quite clear that he came into power with almost exactly the opposite position of Jimmy Carter. He came in with a feeling that arms control was a dubious thing to do, and that one should be very, very cautious in moving. He characterized immediately the SALT II treaty as fatally flawed, and said he would never submit it for ratification, and of course hasn't. He said similarly that he was refused to negotiate on a comprehensive test ban, that in fact testing was important, and we shouldn't even think about negotiating a test ban. He seriously weakened the already pretty weak Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. The budget was cut quite substantially. He brought in a senior level hawk, a bright, able man, but who was distinctly conservative on any arms control at all, by the name of Eugene Rostow, and as the first head of the Arms Control Agency. After he left, he brought in a junior grade hawk, a young, comparatively inexperienced man by the name of Edelman. And as someone who was in the agency in its sort of somewhat brief heyday of sense of accomplishment, it left me feeling really badly when I see not once but on two or three occasions that the lineup of forces is ACDA on the side of the Pentagon arrayed against the State Department. And somehow or another, my instinct is that the right place for ACDA is to be in a position of pushing both agencies toward more. So anyway, it's been a poor year. Part of it was that the President Reagan did come into office committed to a major buildup in U.S. forces, U.S. military forces, feeling that they were weak and it was dangerous and that they had to be substantially increased. And, you know, it's true that that was sort of competitive. I think up until just a few weeks ago, one would have said that, well, the likelihood of serious arms control is pretty small. And there's Reykjavik, which has in it the elements of a really major breakthrough. I mean, the combination of the sort of the joint agreement by those two negotiators to remove all intermediate range nuclear missiles from Europe, and apparently agreement that to strive in 5 years for 50% reduction in strategic ballistic missiles. You know, heavens above, that would be such a great accomplishment, and would move toward arms control and toward lessening the arms race. What will happen, I don't know. But if it is true that Reykjavik will be negotiated and will the essential points of it will turn out to be installed between the two nations, why everything I've said about Ronald Reagan will have to be qualified with the most important thing, namely that he really did negotiate some very important things. So one can wait and see. Well, I should stop, and I've talked too long, I realize. Incidentally, I just should add one thing. A surprisingly constant thing during this period has been that all through the last 6-8 years, the U.S. public has consistently, in the polls, indicated a strong interest in arms control. So that it is a period when the U.S. public has been, on the whole, less volatile, and on the whole, rather clearly desirous of arms control measures. Again, the strength of that I don't know, but nevertheless, it's an important dimension in this current situation. Well,
that's all right. This was excellent.
Well, we had a tour d'horizon of the various presidents and their approach to arms control in the beginning and the middle and the end of each of their terms, the theory as well as the results of some of them. Who'd like to ask the first question? John Reddick.
I wonder if you could pick up on your story about the comprehensive test ban efforts and bring us up to date as to the prospects now, and also this new private initiative of the Natural Resources Defense Council.
I'll say two things. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty is a treaty that has 99 lives. It didn't get signed in the Eisenhower days, and again it didn't, and again it didn't. People could be coming back to it, and it has become a kind of symbol that if you can't make agreement on that, why, you know, what's your chance of others? Many people have said, well, you know, one ought to push it aside. There are more important things to negotiate on than a comprehensive test ban. But as I say, the symbolic element seems to be a very important one. It's clear that the Soviet have been pressing. Gorbachev has announced two moratoria. Well, he announced one and then extended it, and I guess it's still in force, isn't it? I think the last sort of date is now the end of this year. But for about a year and a half, the Soviet Union has not tested any nuclear weapons. So they say, and so do informal monitoring, which is pretty formal, I must say, indicate. So that the pressure from the Soviet is to get together, and it's true that Reykjavik had a sort of a tentative agreement to go ahead there, sort of in stages. That worries me because it sounds like a many-year period, whereas I think myself it's all ready to negotiate. I don't think there's any problem. I think we know absolutely how to monitor those tests with adequate sensitivity and assurance. It's just a great shame. It is now, I think, not a problem of not a technical problem. I think the verification procedures are, I think, well established and quite firm. And fundamentally, that very interesting initiative, that private initiative in which a group of American arms control people and seismologists asked permission to come to the Soviet Union and install seismometers and sort of monitor tests, which haven't been any yet, from the Soviet Union to be sure that the factors of difference between the Soviet Union and the U.S. in terms of their test sites, the calibration factors, be quite sure. And in turn, the United States has granted permission from the Soviet to install three similar small stations in areas around our test site. And that is a very interesting initiative. It's the kind of thing that one always feels good about, namely that these people that did that
had a good idea and managed to get it through. It was neither a large nor potent or highly established U.S. group, but they had a good idea. I was very impressed. As to the prospects, maybe I should make it clear, I am fundamentally optimistic. I really think that arms control is so clearly needed between our two countries for a number of reasons that I didn't dwell on, that it will come about. And I would like to think that Reykjavik will be another push toward it. I think that surprisingly, since I don't privately feel it's one of the most important things we can do, I think we'll get a comprehensive test ban in the next 4 or 5 years. All of the alleged difficulties are now clear, and it's now time that somebody puts a toe in the water and tries it.
Yes, sir. Assuming that we started to get these substantial reductions in nuclear weapons, where along the scale of nuclear weapons reduction do you think we'd have to reintroduce universal military service on the assumption that the Soviets had not negotiated away their conventional advantage?
Well, because you're making an assumption, and I have no idea how firm it is, namely that they will not negotiate. We will try to negotiate and fail. I mean, you may be right. And I suppose I should answer the question making that same assumption. We do try. Well, you know, my own reaction is that let's just guess a nuclear force of 500 nuclear warheads mounted on three or four kinds of carriers, my own preference being on for submarines, but nevertheless, put as well, on each side would be an ample and stable deterrent, and yet a very major deterrent indeed. The destruction that could come from 500 nuclear weapons is, or half of them, if somebody got rid of half of them by attacking, is very, very extensive. And it's one would think twice. Remember that two other nations, namely the United Kingdom and France, have very substantial nuclear weapons themselves. Not enough to look really serious compared to the U.S. and the Soviet Union levels. I don't know what to say about the question of what all that would mean to the situation with conventional forces. I don't know whether the universal military service is the answer. If you postulate that once these things have happened, the Soviet will increase both the level as well as the armaments for their conventional forces, and that what? That the Europeans will refuse to respond in any way, so that all
that's
the response,
pretty good assumption.
All the rest is up to the United States? Well, I don't know. Maybe I should listen to your argument as to why it is that we'll have to have to. Fundamentally, your argument is we would have greatly to expand our conventional military forces, isn't that so?
Fundamentally, my assumption is that we can't match the Soviet Union in conventional forces with a professional army. It just costs too much.
Well, it is expensive.
I mean, that's the biggest part of
the
military budget now.
I agree with you. You're quite right in saying that cost of people cost is a principal cost for the military. No doubt you're right. Well, I'll just say that I don't know.
And what is the reason that the Russians are so afraid of are advancing our Star Wars, if that is true?
Let me talk a little bit about the technical thing and then maybe speculate about the other one, which is, since I think it's pretty hard to know what's in their minds. Let's see, what was your first question?
Well, first is, I wanted to know how much truth there is that the Russians have made substantial progress in development of a Star Wars of their own.
Well, I'm deeply interested in that and can't be firm about it. And the reason is that when you ask that of a Weinberger or one of his scientific people, they say information is classified, and you know, they look at and say, well, you know, you're not cleared for it, and so I can't tell you. And absent the information, why you are rather trapped. I think the case against them being as advanced as we, anything like as advanced as we, is very strong. I think they're substantially behind us, and I say it because there are just a whole set of technologies that are clearly important here, in which we have been years ahead of them. Miniaturization, in a very general sense, is something which becomes exceedingly important as you go to space because of the weight problem. And I don't think there's any question that we're ahead of that. Computers, we see extreme difficulties in being able to develop the computers that can manage a Star Wars system with our very much deeper knowledge of computers. And so that, you know, put it in the Soviet, I just don't see how they could be thought of as a serious opponent in the Star Wars. Now, there's at least one area where there is an indication that they have done more. Whether one would use the word advanced, I don't know. And that is that they have built at least one very powerful laser, and they have, and here this is not a point of evidence, but people in the administration have said that they have fired it at least once at some object in space. I guess we can now say we too have fired lasers at some objects in space. We did destroy a satellite, if you remember, with elderly dying satellite and such. But at least, presumably, the Soviet did it before. Seriously, one should take that. I don't know. I will say that by all odds, the most interesting laser to this country now, and for very good reasons, I think, is something called the free electron laser. It has some interesting characteristics, particularly in efficiency of using power, which make it interesting. And secondly, it turns out to be one in which you can vary the frequency of the light quite easily to sort of suit your particular purposes. And and we have almost abandoned the chemical lasers. I mean, the Star Wars people seem to have abandoned and decreased the amount of budget for the chemical lasers. And the Soviet are, I think, very clearly behind us in the free electron laser. On the other hand, it would be wrong not to point out that that is an area in which their technology happens to be, lasers specifically, happen to be quite strong. I mean, the Nobel Prize that was awarded for lasers turned out to be given to two people, a Soviet and the U.S., who were sort of considered to be jointly deserving of a prize. So the Soviet are advanced in that field, but Star Wars overall has got a lot of fields to it, and I think there are just a lot of technologies where they're well behind.
Behind, although they've probably spent more on it than we have, right?
Well, if you want to know what's a perennial discussion without much resolution, it's how much money did the Soviets spend on military systems. Indeed, how much the Soviets spend on anything. Their budgets don't show it. Anyway, you may be right.
Late Middle Age.
Regarding the disarmament agency of which you were a member, did the scope of the responsibilities extend to nations other than the superpowers? Did you have a concern for Israel and India and South Africa such that
yeah.
that was an aspect? And if so, what was the depth of the personnel who were assigned to those responsibilities, and perhaps if you're able to comment their competence?
Well, the first point you have to say is that the Arms Control Agency has always been a very small agency, you know, budgets in the $10 million, maybe 20, that sort of thing, and a very small group of people fundamentally, and very small indeed compared to the State Department, for example, and very, very small compared to the Department of Defense. So that there was, I think, no real expectation that it could ever cover in depth the breadth of fields that our foreign policy could get involved in. I think it's fair to say that certainly during my 2 years there, and to the best of my knowledge during most of the others, that 75% at least of their effort went toward not simply U.S.-Soviet, but U.S.-NATO-Soviet, that complex of bilateral and NATO Soviet relations. And the amount, therefore, put into other nations, into situations in Africa, even in the Middle East, which probably was the next most discussed and analyzed, I would have to say that nothing I know would say that the Arms Control Agency added major new knowledge to almost any of the areas, except perhaps and primarily, I guess, where they really have been useful has been in the major U.S.-Soviet confrontation. But I think one would have to say that not a lot in these others.
Fred Richardson.
What is the proportion of U.S. cheating compared to USSR cheating?
Well, as a sturdy U.S. citizen, I base my posture on the assumption that the U.S. Cheats much less. Anyway, I'm committed to that. And I also believe it.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you have to understand that these charges of cheating are complicated indeed, and the difference between charges of cheating and cheating can be quite considerable. And for example, I think that the case for what we have been particularly vehement in charging the Soviets of cheating on, namely their use of chemical weapons in the Vietnam, Cambodia region, I think the evidence for that is pitifully small. And I think it has tended to erode rather than strong. I mean, in the year why the Canadians and British have independently brought in analytical data of some of these famous samples, which in effect argue that the U.S. data on those samples, which is already pretty thin, looks even thinner. There's a phrase used in talking about things like cheating, which is an illuminating one. The phrase is the smoking gun. Have you found the smoking gun? What it really means is the really hard evidence that says, there you have the evidence that then. Now, the smoking gun in that mm-hmm. Vietnam area would be a significant number, maybe even only a few, of canisters or equivalent that had some reasonable coupling to the Soviet Union or to an ally, and that had some residual chemical weapons of chemical warfare in them. You'd really have something then. As far as I know, there's never been any smoking gun evidence sort of uncovered. But take a different case where it's clear that the Soviet have been cheating, or I think it is at least, and that's the question of the radar, the still incompleted radar that's being erected in Krasnoyarsk out in Siberia.
which certainly seems to be by the technical people, that's not my field, I really don't know, but the technical people seem to be pretty firm in saying that the most obvious thing is that it is presumably a radar to look outward and a part of an ABM complex, and there's a clear thing that says those shall be on the coast, and whatever it is not on the coast. It's several hundred miles from the coast. So that in that sense, it looks like it's bending the in violation of the agreement. Now, as to what its purpose is, the Soviets, of course, as you know, say that it's not for ABM use at all. Got some space command situations. Our people poo-poo it, and not knowing at all one way or the other, I believe our people that it really. The Soviets said, you know, when it's completed, you can come and see it and see for yourself. As for a while. Who knows what? That's a long ways away. But it is worth commenting that the Soviet have charged that we too have been playing fast and loose with these radars. We have apparently, there's one, I think, with some funny name like Flying Gate. Does somebody know what it is up in the north of Great Britain or someplace? Properly pointed outward. But apparently we are doing a major renovation of that, which apparently also is not in agreement with the treaty, or at least so the Soviet charge. And I guess all I'm saying is that some cases, like Krasnoyarsk, look pretty clear. On the other hand, I think one has to be a little cautious about some of the charges of Kiev. There have been mutual charges on both sides. Yes?
With respect to the question that was asked about the necessity to match conventional forces in order to stay on equal footing with the Russians, I take comfort from some figures that came out some years ago that if NATO forces stay on the defensive, they don't need nearly to match in order to remain completely equal so far as the ability to defend themselves is concerned. There's a difference of maybe almost 50% in the numbers that are required, and I wonder if that's still holding up as a possibility and a comfort to us.
I know that said, I'm certainly no expert, and I do know that it's almost routine for people to say that you need twice as many attacking troops as defensive troops to break through. I just have no idea what is the ratio and whether it still holds or whether methods. Personally, I'm significantly more pessimistic about what would happen if there were a conventional war, simply because the idea of putting one coherent force, namely the Soviet force, against the mixed force of about five nations seems to me to be one where I think I put my money on the one nation. It just seems to me the command and control situation on the NATO front on our side is not very good. The other thing, of course, that I really do believe is that it's very hard for me to envisage a conventional war that doesn't go nuclear. It just seems to me that the implications of that war are so great it just seems to me that escalation is virtually guaranteed, even if you don't count the French and United Kingdom nuclear forces, which I think you should. So I like to hope that nuclear deterrence, in the sense of being truly fearful of what the outcome of war will be, is playing some role on that conventional. There are lots of other things I'd like to see. I think that that we ought to be making much more noise than we do about the forward deployment of the Soviets. Fundamentally, you can't help but ask the question, why in heaven's name have they got so many of their forces on a sort of a 50-mile perimeter along that Iron Curtain line? Anyway, I because of the nuclear threat, I have mild optimism that war on that conventional front will be avoided. Somebody else may know that for you. Yes, sir.
Well, this is on a little different subject, but suppose we do have to make a breakthrough following Reykjavik. To what extent is the world still endangered by other countries that are nuclear now, that have the nuclear capability, and how do we deal with that element aside from the two major powers?
Well, let me go through the numbers. Of course, now we have a few thousand delivery systems, the U.S. between submarines and ICBMs, and now cruise missiles, which will carry nuclear weapons. And the Soviets have a comparable number. They are much behind us currently in cruise missiles, but I have no doubt that they'll build up and have comparable numbers there too. Both of those forces are, of course, enormously large, as well as diverse, compared to what the British and the UK has. I mean the French. I think the French force is probably the next most significant after the two superpowers, but it's a big drop down. And they are, however, steadily building it up, not at a very fast rate, but still the slope is upward. The UK, as you know, is politically, it's all very uncertain what's going to happen there. Their program is to essentially have effectively the new Trident-type submarine and missiles so that they can have longer-range missiles and quieter submarines and other things. On the other hand, that's a very controversial program. Who knows what politically will happen there. But beyond those two, it's a pretty severe drop. I mean, China has got a significant number. It probably is mixed in the number. It is, I guess. They too are building up, and they're well behind in a decade or two, but nevertheless the direction is upward. They are apparently going in for submarines. I mean, they already have at least one submarine, and apparently they're going in for more modern ones. When you drop below those, of course, then it is a drop into the unknown, because then you get to Israel. Does Israel have nuclear weapons? Most people seem to now feel with some firmness that they do, but do they have 10, or do they have 50, or do they have 100? Seems to be the kind of range of speculation. Does South Africa have nuclear warheads? There's a moderate feeling that they probably do. On the other hand, I think much less is known there, even whether they have them, let alone how many. And I think then you're about finished. I think then you get into real speculation. But it does suggest that the United States and the Soviet Union could drop their nuclear missiles down by a factor of 10 or 20 and still be substantially ahead of any of those nations. Now, what happens if the others continue to build up and the United States stays down on the Soviet Union?
Nancy. You seem to feel that Mr. Nixon's bold act in stopping the biological war was very good. Do you think that today the climate with Gorbachev is conducive to another bold act?
Well, yes, I do. And I think it's rather interesting that we're in that, it seems to me, slightly embarrassing position where we say we would like, with safety and all the qualifiers you want to put on, we would like arms control. We'd like to stop the arms race. I mean, there's a very strong consensus that that's a good way to go. And typically, we have been very much more doubtful whether that is, in fact, a goal that the Soviets really want. we listen to their remarks with a little skepticism. On the other hand, in this recent period, the initiatives have been coming from the Soviet Union,
quite clearly. Mm-hmm.
And I think to the point now where it's becoming slightly politically embarrassing to the current administration. I do feel, in a different way, that both nations could have sensibly, indeed any nation, could have sensibly thought of unilateral moves to take. I mean, there's some unilateral moves that you take just because it makes sense to take them, not because it necessarily is a move on a nuclear checkerboard, but just sensible. We destroyed order magnitude a couple of thousand of B-47 bombers back in the very early 1960s. They were jet bombers, they were nuclear carrying bombers, and we destroyed them because they were relative to our oncoming bomber, which was the B-52, they were very much less efficient, more costly to maintain, not long enough range, and we destroyed them because they didn't make sense to us, to our forces. Now, so we shouldn't especially get any kudos for it. On the other hand, we could have done some things that would have been a lot less pleasant. We could have given those in substantial numbers to some of our allies and upset the balance in the Middle East, for example, or heaven knows what. So that in a certain sense, by moving them out, we did not only get rid of what to us was truly obsolescent, but we did not put it in the hands of other people that might use it in ways that would or would not be helpful for peace. There really are, you know, many things that countries could do on their own to Nixon did with biological weapons. It's the theorists have worried about this a good deal, and two or three theorists have worked with the notion of what's called reciprocal unilateral moves. You know, I take more, and that's really, by the way, what Gorbachev was seeking for. He said, you know, I'm going to have a moratorium on nuclear testing. And he was clearly at us. And if he didn't say it, some of the other people in the Soviet Union did. How about you guys over there? What about a moratorium? Now, so that kind of unilateral move which requests a response. And I think, in all honesty, that's really what the Nixon one was, too. It was a unilateral move to say, let's get moving on the biological weapons, and the United States will take the first one. But it is an area which is played much too little, because it has the virtues that you can take a significant move yourself. You don't have to go through this painful negotiating process, and you don't have it. It does surprise me that we and the Soviet and indeed other countries don't do more of that.
I'm sure I speak for all of you in saying this has been the most illuminating discussion, and we're terribly grateful to Franklin Long. This afternoon he'll talk a little bit about the President's science advising process, and you're all welcome. Thank you very much.